Hey, welcome to Beauty at Work. We're in between seasons, but for the moment, here's a clip from one of our episodes. Is beauty a matter of nature or nurture? Is it hardwired in the brain, or is it conditioned by culture? Neuroscientist Dr. Anjan Chatterjee challenges this dichotomy. In this clip, he points out that although beauty is in the brain of the beholder, our brains are more similar than they are different. Check it out. Is beauty something that we're sort of naturally inclined to, or is it completely conditioned by our nurture and our culture? Or is there anything objective about beauty, or is it completely in the eye of the beholder? Can we gain any traction into some of those thorny questions by studying neuroaesthetics?
I think so. There are some assumptions in even the framing of that question that I'd at least like to examine. One is the notion that is talked about commonly of how things are either culture or they're hardwired in the brain. And that is a dichotomy I think is worth at least examining and perhaps resisting. The example that is clearest in my mind that most people would have a sense of is reading and writing. Most of us and many of your listeners will be literate and will know how to read and write. And it's a little bit mysterious. Why is it that these little squiggles of line somehow conjure up meaning and poetry in our brains? But it's a very specific kind, which is if you know English, then you can read that. If you don't know Hindi, all you see are a bunch of squiggles, right? There's nothing that is penetrating you with respect to the meaning of what those visual forms have. So reading and writing is very much of a cultural artifact. And in the long history of humanity, most people have not known how to read and write, right? So it's a very much of a cultural artifact that many of us now have the privilege of possessing. It turns out in our occipital cortex, in our visual brain, which carves out the world into different domains. So there's a part of our visual system that is very sensitive to people. There's a part that's very sensitive to places. There's a part that's very sensitive to things. It turns out there's also an area that is referred to as the visual word form area. So there's a little bit of real estate in our occipital brain, in our visual brain, that is dedicated to processing these lines and squiggles into words. Now, so on those grounds, you would say this is hardwired, but we've already said this is a cultural artifact. And so the point being that culture still has to work through the brain at a level of the individual. And so culture can have its imprint on the brain in the same way that we think, you know, brains, individual brains as a collective has an influence on culture. So, you know, for us, one way as scientists that we are always thinking about this is what's the nature of variability and how do you explain variability? And some aspects of and we'll get to beauty in a second, but some aspects of variability are very consistent across people and across cultures. And some vary by culture, by age, by experience, and so on. And so understanding variability is ultimately the core. And when things vary by experience, is still written into the brain. So we can still look at the brain to try to understand that kind of variability. So going to your question about beauty, it looks fairly consistent that it depends on what we're talking about. So I already mentioned that we carve out the world into people, places, and things. People are generally quite consistent in faces that they think are beautiful. People are pretty consistent in landscapes, natural landscapes that they think are beautiful. People are very inconsistent in artwork. And architecture seems to be somewhere closer to art than to natural landscapes. And I think the big picture that's emerging out of this is that with natural kinds, you know, with people and natural environments, we tend to be more consistent. When people say beauty is in the eye of the beholder, my usual response is beauty is in the brain of the beholder. And our brains are more similar than they're different from each other. So I think those kinds of natural environments that are how our brains evolved tend to be more consistent. But then human artifacts is where things really diverge. And people's response to that are far more susceptible to, again, culture, background experience, education, where you even happen to be living, even within your town, if you live in Center City or you live in a suburb or you live, those things all have a huge impact.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you've talked about in, defining aesthetic experience or understanding it is seeing it as an emergent property of three interrelated systems, distinct but interacting systems in the brain, right? Could you tell us a little bit about that aesthetic triad and what we can learn from that?
Yeah, so we talk about it as the aesthetic triad, and that has these three kinds of large-scale systems. One has having to do with the organization of our sensory and motor systems. One having to do with the organization of our emotional systems and how we receive pleasure and reward in the world. And the third having to do with semantics and meaning. And just to give examples of each of those, a trivial example for the sensory part might be that you can be out at a beautiful sunset over the beach and you appreciate how beautiful it is. And most people would have some reaction to that kind of a scene. But there's a lot of information out in the world, for example, in the infrared spectrum of the sunset, that we just don't have the sensory receptors to even apprehend that. So there's stuff out in the world of which there's a sliver that we are even sensitive to based on the design of our sensory systems. And so that puts some guardrails on the kinds of things we can have a beauty experience of. The motor system, similarly, there are certain biomechanical constraints on our motor system. So when you're watching dance, certain kinds of movements will be regarded as more elegant, more graceful, but movements that don't follow the ways in which our joints work can be almost repulsive at times, that there's something odd about it. And so that's an example of things on the sensory motor side. With emotions, especially when we're talking about beauty, pleasure seems to be the most important piece of that, is that we get pleasure from things that are beautiful. And to a first approximation, the experience of beauty seems to be the combined neural activity of both the object, so let's say we're looking at a beautiful face, the combined neural activity within our visual brain in an area called the fusiform face area, it's a fusiform gyrus, the activity there and in our pleasure systems, which are in the front of the brain and deep structures, when both those areas are activated simultaneously, that's a kind of biologic description of what the experience of seeing a beautiful face is. Right, so that's the idea is that these pleasure systems tap into very ancient systems in the brain that apply to food and sex and all of the other things that motivate us and drive us in that way. But when it comes to art and other things that the kind of emotions that are evoked can be quite nuanced. Doesn't have to, it's not the same as putting a little bit of sugar on your tongue, right? You can have, elements of anxiety, you can have elements of fear, when people talk about the sublime as an important construct of aesthetic experiences, there is a sense in which you're talking about something that is beautiful, but also vast and a bit scary, and it makes you feel insignificant maybe at the same time. So these aren't simple, these don't necessarily have to be simple emotions. And again, even in popular culture, people pay a lot of money to go watch horror movies. You know, Halloween is coming up, right? People, it's an aesthetic experience to go get scared. Yeah. People are willing to do that. So the emotion part, and this is one area that is active area of research in my world, is like, you know, in the first 10 years, everybody's focused on beauty and pleasure. But now it's more like, what are these more nuanced combinations, the combinatorial properties of emotions, and how do we even try to get at that? And then the third part of this, which is we were talking a little bit about before around semantics and meaning, but really, how does even the labeling of a work of art have an influence on how you think about it, or whether you know something about the particular culture that in which the art was produced, you know, the time, the familiarity of the artwork. For example, the other example I like using is that if you ask most Americans right now, what class of paintings do they like? The most common answer you typically get are Impressionist paintings. People love Impressionist paintings. You know, but 150 years ago, when they first came on the scene, they were derided. You know, the salons in Paris didn't even think this was really art. Like, why are we showing this? Our brains haven't really changed in 150 years. So there's something about the zeitgeist of the culture over that period went from being really avant-garde, challenging the status quo. And the same thing now is, you know, the most beloved kind of images that, you know, I mean, college students have those painting, you know, posters of those in probably every dorm in America.
Right.
Yeah, what is the, I mean, is there a kind of weighting process, I suppose, in terms of what is the relationship between these three systems, right? I suppose, are there ways in which, you know, to put it crudely, like, you know, can you sort of add them all up and say, you know, an experience that hits all three systems is more beautiful than one that hits only one of them? Or is there a qualitative distinction between these, right? Because we can, I mean, I think aesthetic experience, like moral judgment, seems to be a second order phenomenon where we can ask ourselves, yeah, I find that pleasing, but should I? And we can have that sort of reflection. And I wonder, how does that sort of affect the nature of these aesthetic experiences? Does that moral meaning-making dimension have a sort of a more privileged space, or is it, are they just all somehow equally weighted in our experiences? If that makes sense.
Yeah. So I'd say when we talk about the triad, that's one thing. And if we add on to that moral valuation, that's another layer on top of all of that, and which is something we're quite interested in. So going back to the first one, I was just talking to a museum curator who she wants to do an exhibit in which principles of neuroaesthetics are highlighted as part of an art exhibit. And so one way, these are very early days in our conversation, but one is to say, let's take this triad and really pick artwork that very much emphasize one of the three, even recognizing that almost always they're intermixed. So you could imagine very vivid, colorful paintings like the Fauvist did, you know, as part of the sensory part, right? It's like in your face, right? The sensory qualities of the images. You could imagine the German expressionists or certain kinds of Baroque paintings where the emotions are just jacked up almost to the point of seeming overly dramatic, right? But it just hits you in the face, right? The kind of emotions being expressed. And then for the meaning part, it's a lot of contemporary conceptual art, right? If you know, the Philadelphia Museum has one of Duchamp's urinals on a pedestal, look, a urinal on its side has a kind of pleasing shape, I grant you that. Right. But the power of that art is really around the conceptual point that Duchamp was making, right? So I think with each of these, you know, you can show how the artwork is really pushing on, you know, more on one or the other of these triads. You know, we were talking about Impressionists, and I can't remember I'm trying to think of who the quote was from. It might have been Picasso, but I'm not sure. Talking about Monet saying, you know, he was just an eye, but what an eye. And so by that, I think he was really talking about how sensitive to the sensory qualities of the image Monet was. So I think that's one way in which you can think about how different artworks, you know, vary and how much they weigh on the triad. The question of morality, I think, is fascinating because it's a whole other system of valuation, right? What we're talking about is how when we look out in the world, we can classify things by what they are and they're, you know, I know that this is, you know, there's a table in front of me. I know I have a little, you know, cup over here that, you know, I just had some espresso so I could be alert for this conversation. But values are a whole other thing, right? It's something we're adding on to that. And aesthetic and moral values are two principal kinds of values. There might be utilitarian values, might be another one that seems to be quite important. Our view is that our brains are very good at discriminating between objects, but sloppy at assigning values. And by that, I mean that if you, again, go back to the ancient Greeks who thought that three fundamental values that contributed to our sense of humanity were goodness, beauty, and truth, we think with varying degrees of evidence to back up this intuition is that those get conflated all the time. And in our research, we're finding, particularly with faces, that beautiful faces, if they have various kinds of facial anomalies, so these could be scars, these could be birthmarks, these could be developmental abnormalities, that people with typical faces, without even realizing it, make characterologic judgments of those faces as being less intelligent, less competent, less trustworthy, less, you know, less hardworking, and so on. And it's the other side of what social psychologists have talked about as a beauty is good stereotype. So here you have something that is a person who is beautiful or has something that's getting in the way of their beauty, and people without realizing it are then ascribing morality to that somehow they're either better than or worse than, strictly based on appearance that's somewhere along a beauty axis.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, is it because we are trying to make beauty a heuristic? Is that is it essentially operating as a shortcut for helping us navigate through the world here, right? Is that...
Yeah, I think it might be. You know, one of the things that we were interested in is, and I mentioned this in The Aesthetic Brain, the book you mentioned in the beginning, of a kind of, there's an evolutionary story that is sometimes told and a story that we have told as well, which is there is a built into us is our mechanisms, a heuristic to be sensitive to people's immune status, and it's an adaptation to understand how people's pathogen sensitivity, right? So if you are particularly easily affected by pathogens, and most pathogens tend to produce disfigurements, whether that's in plants or animals or people, right? So it's a signal to say, okay, you know, maybe this person isn't the best possible mate. And not to say that this is all done explicitly, it's all like these heuristics that are built into it. We recently finished a study that at least challenges that notion, where we went to, with some colleagues here at Penn who do field work in Tanzania, we did a study with the hunter-gatherer tribe called the Hadza. You know, there are about 500 to 1,000 of people of this indigenous culture there that still move around in camps of 20 or so people. And so the question was, would they have the same kind of biases we are seeing very consistently in our studies here? And if this pathogen sensitivity argument is correct, we should see it there, because those are the kinds of conditions in which people think that evolutionarily this got built into our brain. But what we find is that they actually don't have the same kind of biases. And in fact, if you examine them with these scales that start to indicate how much exposure to non-Hadza culture they have. So it's a questionnaire that asks things like, does the name Nelson Mandela mean anything to you? Do you know any words of Swahili, right? So you kind of get a sense of how much exposure they've had. We start to see, as they have exposure, more exposure, that these same kinds of stereotypes that we have start to emerge. So it's the first paper that I know of, there may be others, but that argues that culture may have a big role to play in this.
Beauty at Work is brought to you by Templeton Religion Trust. If you enjoyed this clip, go check out the full episode. And please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a review. It really helps get the word out about the show. Thanks, and see you next time.